Welcome back to the Ed Morris Show podcast. I am happy to talk for the first time to Paul Rowland. He's a filmmaker. He did the film Exemplum, which has been out for about a year. It's a low-budget Christian thriller. And our mutual friend, Mark Judge, has written about this. And Paul, he was like needling me to talk to you about this. And I'm really happy he did. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Ed. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, when people are seeing this, they're going to see the name Paul Bois on the screen as well. Now, that's your byline over at Breitbart, right? You are a contributor over at Breitbart.com.
That's correct. I'm a writer at Breitbart.com. I write every day for them. And they have been very supportive throughout this process. They've promoted the film since its inception. So I've been very grateful for that. But yes, my regular name is Paul Bois. My directorial name is Paul Rowland.
There you go. Absolutely. And we just want to make sure that we are promoting all the places that you're at.
Yes.
And so, you know, John Nolte a little bit then?
I do. I speak with him almost weekly.
He's a great guy. John's a friend. And it's great that you're working with him over there. So let's talk a little bit first about the film Exemplum. This is a Christian thriller made for $10,000, which is, you know, your usual star's lunch budget, you know, in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, and Mark was saying he wrote a piece. It was probably about a month or two ago about how it was better than Killers of the Flower Moon.
Yeah, he wrote that in October of last year. Yeah,
mm-hmm. That long ago, because I remember when I read it. So yeah, time flies.
Yeah.
6 months ago. So it's better than Killers of the Flower Moon. Tell us a little bit about the film itself. What is Exemplum about?
Okay, so Exemplum is about a Catholic priest who, out of paranoia, starts recording his confessions. And then he starts playing those recordings back. He gets obsessed with them. And in the process, he gets this idea for an internet show called Exemplum. And Exemplum, if you don't know, they're morality tales, medieval morality tales. Geoffrey Chaucer had written them. A lot of medieval writers had done an Exemplum of some kind. They were usually poems or tales that explored foibles or people's sins and how it led them to sort of a downfall, and it was always kind of a moral lesson in the end. So he gets this idea for this show, Exemplum. It becomes a hot topic, and he's using the recorded confessions as inspiration for that. It becomes a big thing on social media. And then through bureaucracy and corruption in the church, all of that gets wiped out. His show is canceled, his social media is silenced, and he's going to be sent to this parish out in the middle of nowhere, and he's basically, his life is destroyed. So in his bitterness, in his crisis of faith, he decides to take one of those recordings and blackmail a wealthy parishioner with it. In the process, he gets linked up with a hacker, and it becomes this cat and mouse game that spirals way out of control from there.
Wow. Yeah, that does sound interesting. As a Catholic myself, and I know that you're Catholic, I mean, just the secretly recording confessions, now I'm just going to be, you know, covered in night sweats for the next couple of nights.
There. Yes. Yeah. It's a lot of paranoia in there. Yeah, for sure. The concept of that was fascinating for me, you know, because I mean, a lot of the, we already mentioned that this was done on a low budget. So when you're writing something like that, you have to write in the confines of what you know you can get for free. So I knew I could get a Catholic church for free and various apartments, maybe a bar, a restaurant, and then shoot guerrilla style. And I did have in the back of my mind, I don't know, you know, just something about a priest recording his confessions. I didn't know what that was or where that would go, but that was so intriguing to me about how that could be a film noir, about how that could be a thriller, because the concept of taking people's sins, their secrets, and that you're supposed to be, you know, spiritually washing away, but you're keeping them locked up and locked inside. That was compelling to me about what kind of story could come out of that. So that's why I explored it.
Well, right. I mean, for myself too, I mean, that's part of what confession is supposed to be about, is that these things, it's a little too glib to say, well, they just vanish and they don't go away, because mm-hmm. Catholic, and maybe Exemplum explores this, is that what it's saying is that you've been forgiven for these sins, but the consequences of those sins still remain, right? The consequences in this world still remain. So if you're doing something bad, just because you've gone to confession and confessed it, well, you're forgiven for those sins, but you're going to still have to deal with the detritus of what it was that you were doing. I'm wondering
yes.
if you're going in that direction.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. So, well, that's certainly a concept explored in the film, especially with the character that he decides to blackmail, Louis Costa, he's a restaurateur, a millionaire, and he's constantly coming into confession every week, confessing all these, you know, horrible things that he's doing, you know, sleeping with call girls. You know, he fires a waitress because he was attracted to her and he couldn't stand going into work and being around her. So he like had an associate come in and you know, lie about her on Yelp. So he had an excuse to fire. I mean, he's an awful man, and it just starts draining the main character, Colin, having to listen to him, you know, give this every week because he knows he's just coming in to just feel better about himself. There's nothing contrite about it at all.
Right.
But the movie does go into the exploration about, you know, does Colin have the right to judge his soul? Because he actually doesn't. And he finds out things about Louis' soul that he didn't, you know, realize once, you know, things start heating up between them. And then it really becomes a reflection upon the lack of grace in our social media age about how everything we do is always locked up, always there, available for people to use as weapons for control at some point in time. And that's, I think, the moral lesson of the film. It wasn't one that I set out to really say when I was writing, but it was sort of occurred as it was coming, is that this is really a good reflection upon where we live now, that there is no forgiveness in our age of social media. All of our sins are out there ready to be available at any point in time for people to use against you.
You almost have to not want to explore that. If you're writing, how long is Exemplum? Is this feature length?
It's 96 minutes.
96 minutes feature length film. There's no way you can avoid that if you're developing this organically and if you're setting it in the present time. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, that is one of the interesting questions, I think, in our age. And one of the reasons why I think, you know, particularly the Catholic faith, but Christianity in general, offers a true path, right? Because there's forgiveness, there's atonement, there's redemption, there's forgiveness, right? And you're right, on social media there isn't. And this is sort of flirting with the idea, right, that, well, there's really no such thing as redemption, there's really no such thing as atonement if the sins are held. Mm-hmm. Like this. So I haven't seen this film yet, but everything I'm hearing makes me want to see it more, because I think that this is a key part of what we call cancel culture, which is you have all the sins and none of the redemption. You have all the confessions and none of the forgiveness. And we can go, I don't want to necessarily go too, you know, ideological with, there's reasons for that in the structure of how progressives do things. But I mean, that's not an attractive philosophy. And whereas, you know, confession, redemption, atonement, redemption, especially, I love a redemption story, right?
Absolutely.
Even bad redemption stories, I got to tell you, I choke up at even bad redemption stories. I can't give you an example, but there's films I know that aren't good, but because it's a redemption story, then I go, oh, okay. And I'm assuming now that this is part of what the pull of Exemplum is the dark side of what happens when people interfere with that.
Yes, yes. And I think it's also about the dark side of being obsessed with other people's sins. And when we talk about cancel culture, I try not to use it. And, you know, I'm glad you said that about the ideological, you know, position. I don't want to use it as a political tool, because I do think that cancel culture exists in all of our hearts. I think all of us are capable of canceling someone, of you know, misjudging someone based off of something, or expelling them outside of a group. It's something that everyone should be fully aware of. And the idea of, I think, what I see on social media every day from all kinds of people is this looking for flaws in people. There's almost this like glee that people have. Oh, like my enemy, like or the person I don't like. Oh, he's got the flaw that I was looking for. This is it. Like I see it now. Like you're a bad person, and we're just constantly on this hunt for people's sins and using it for power and gain and to gain followers and to gain. Yeah, so there's a lot of fascinating concepts that are explored in the film about how he becomes a social media star, him taking the people's sins, playing them back, creating this platform out of it. It's a lot. I could go on all day about this.
Well, we could go on all day about this, or I could go watch the film, which I plan to do anyway. But, you know, and everybody else should go watch this film, too, because it's not often that we get conservative, or people of conservatives or people of faith who are in a position to make a feature length film about issues like this. And this is not this is not a political polemic. Right. This is an exploration of really almost a spiritual topic here, explicitly a spiritual topic here, but spiritual on a few different levels from what you're telling me, Paul. And to get back to what you're saying about what the kind of film that you can make for $10,000 or what choices you have to make for a film for $10,000, I'd much rather see a film about that for $10,000 than a really bad comic book movie that got a $300 million budget, because it's really about the art and the story. And if you're telling a unique story and you're telling it in a unique way, there's not a lot of money that you have to spend to bring it up to a professional level of production values, right?
I agree. And, and with Exemplum, it is made for $10,000. And I really did lean into the fact that we had nothing. You know, I was very much inspired by the independent filmmakers of the 1990s, people like Christopher Nolan, Robert Rodriguez, Darren Aronofsky, Kevin Smith. Spike Lee, in some ways, was a precursor to them in the late 90s. With She's Got to Have It, because I appreciated these were men from nowhere, and they just had what little money they had, and they were like, all right, we're just gonna make our movies, and they're really cool, interesting films. And then nowadays, with advancement of technology, with the film festival on every street corner, that's kind of been wiped away. So I really wanted to lean into that. That's why the movie's in black and white. That's why I put in the 8mm film grains and really just want to own that corner of like, yes, we are an independent film. I want to look like we just grabbed a 16mm camera and shot this thing. But to add to the point about how, you don't need that much money, that's always been a guiding philosophy of mine. It's been a guiding philosophy since high school, since I got into filmmaking. And the model of spending $100 million, $200 million on a movie is dying. It can't sustain itself. Hollywood is hurting. I think Godzilla Minus One just kind of embarrassed all of them by making a $15 million movie that's a big hit globally and everybody loves. So I think that era is changing. And I really do think it is going to become more about the story, going back to the classic age of what cinema was, and IP-driven projects are just not going to cut it anymore.
Yeah, first off, from what you're describing, Aronofsky is a really good antecedent, I would say. Pi was really, and I had trouble with Pi. I mean, I watched it, but man, it was tough to get through because it was so unusual and it was so raw and it was very, complicated. But you could see that Aronofsky didn't need, a boatload of money from, Disney or Warner's or whoever to make a film of that vision. I would go back to like the 1960s and 1970s, the kind of film that Harvey Keitel started out doing.
Great era, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, just, like you said, take a 16mm camera and go out and shoot, Gonzo style. No permits. So you're running away from the police wherever you're going. I'm not suggesting you did that, but that's there is a track record for that. And some of it turns out to be just nonsense. I mean, some of Andy Warhol's stuff was like that too. But there's some of that stuff that really turns out to be story driven, character driven. And because you're not dealing with all of the rest of the extraneous things, it really focuses in on the story itself and the performances in the film.
Yes.
Let me ask you about the cast. How'd you get the cast involved on
this? Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's a lot of, I mean, I play the main character, Colin, for a lot of reasons. We were shooting, you know, 7 weekends, 21 days, and he's in every scene of the film. I mean, to get an actor to come out, you know, unless he's a very close friend of mine, to play that kind of part is very difficult for no money. And so I knew I could at least play the part. I had a good, you know, training in acting and writing as a screenwriter kind of hones your skills as an actor. So it was easy for me to sort of slip in the roles. Very hard to play both director and actor on a set like this, trust me, but I was able to do it. So that was that. And then I had, for Louis Costa, my friend Joe Griffin, who was part of our Catholic group, Catholic families out here in Pasadena. I'd always known of him. I didn't really know him that well when I reached out to him, though. And but he was an actor. He had done successful work in Canada and stuff in the United States. And then he retired and owned his own pub in South Pass. And I just reached out to him and said, hey, wrote this part. I modeled it after your persona. What do you think? He was like, oh, I love it. Let's do it. So he was Louis Costa right off the bat. And then casting Father Liam was an interesting thing. I had like two actors that I reached out to for that role. They couldn't do it. And then there was one in the back of my mind, Francis Cronin. I met him. He's a comedian through my friend Adam Yenser. And he was a cool Irish guy. We got along. And he was kind of like my third choice. And I said, hey, look, you know, are you able to do this? And he was on board and he killed it. He gave the best performance of the whole film as Father Liam. No question about it. And then Brittany Lewis for Lily, we put out a casting call for that. I knew that was going to be the most difficult part to cast. And so we had to be very particular. So I had my casting director friend, Ray Varela, conduct that for me. And she found Brittany Lewis. Brittany, that actually, look part had voice, just she was down. Yeah,
I mean, because on something like this it's got to be pretty collaborative, because the it's a low budget film and there's not a lot of money to go around, so you really have to get buy-in from everybody who's going to be coming in to do that. And the fact that you even were able to finish it, I think, is a testimony to how much buy-in you got from the people who were working for you.
Oh, yes. I mean, I didn't get into what I was going through personally while I was making this. Okay. We found out my wife was, I mean, I got the initial check to make this movie from, you know, David Horowitz Freedom Center, $6,000 grant, 2 weeks before the pandemic hit. Had the pandemic hit sooner, no way I would have gotten that check. Pandemic hits, I'm writing this screenplay. I have no idea what society's going to look like in the next 6 to 7 months. So I'm writing this while we're under all this stress of lockdowns and everything. And then, you know, and then I finished the script. Then come June, my wife is pregnant. So now that's really adding, you know, pressure. And then in July, our upstairs neighbor, through an act of negligence, he breaks a water main and floods our unit. So me and my pregnant wife, we have to move out of our home for the next 5 months, bouncing around in Airbnbs. I have to make this film because I know I'm not going to get an opportunity like this again. And I have to get it done within the next few months before my baby arrives. So it was wild. And then I did get it shot and then I had to edit it. I was like, I'd staying up till like 3 a.m. Yeah. Every night, you know, while I was a dad, it was madness.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I mean, at a certain point, you have to be wondering, is somebody trying to tell me something? But you had faith in this project, and part of your faith in the project is your faith, your Catholic faith. And
Oh, yes.
Tell us a little bit about how that played. I mean, obviously it played into the story. I mean, we've talked about how it played into the story. How did it play into your approach to the project?
Well, I mean, a major approach, you know, I mean, like my Catholicism is a big source of fiber for me, especially, you know, it forms a big basis of all my storytelling, even if I'm not telling explicitly Catholic Christian story like this one. My morality and my philosophical outlook and my view on humanity will always be in there in some way, shape, or form. So that's number one. And then, yeah, you know, I mean, you are correct about how when those challenges were happening, about, you know, how I was going about it, you know, is this like a, yeah, but I did lean in and I did have that fiber to persist. And, you know, no matter how hard it get, there was always some guiding light that would propel me to the next step. No matter how, I mean, it would get hard. There were days I did not, I mean, after the first night of shooting, I was like, I don't know how I'm going to pull this off, but I just kept putting one foot ahead of the other. And that really did teach me about the nature of directing, to be brutally honest with you. Any director at any high level will tell you that it's not never a clean cut, easy road. It's always controlled chaos. You know, I read Edward Zwick's brilliant memoir just recently, and I saw him speak about it. And he just basically, I mean, he's like, yeah, every day on set is controlled chaos. You know, you don't even know what you're doing half the time. I mean, you're just relying on other people to be pulling things off in your vision. And, you know, things don't go the way you want. You're constantly having to make compromises. That is part of being a director. Part of being a director is just forging through the madness and getting to the end and just trusting that you're going to somehow pull it all together. That really is what directing is. And yeah, my Catholicism really did inform me and guide me through that heavily. Because Catholicism is about persisting, is about, you know, in not allowing the suffering to pull you down, to find the hope, the joy in the darkness. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And so, I mean, I think that maybe too often some of us don't trust in that enough, right? And don't persevere. Mm-hmm. And lose heart. I don't want to say lose faith. But sometimes we lose heart, and it's good to see people who persevere and see it out all the way to the end. And now you have Exemplum. It's been out for about a year, I believe, right?
Yes.
It's building a following. Yes. Where can people find this, first off?
Yes, you can watch it for free on Tubi or YouTube. So it's there if you want to watch it for free. However, I do highly recommend to people, highly, if they can, to either rent it on Google Play, Vimeo On Demand, or YouTube Movies, because you can watch it ad-free in a high-quality stream. And the movie's meant to be watched ad-free in the best quality that you can get it. But it is free on Tubi and YouTube, so you can watch it there.
Well, let's just say that folks who have the wherewithal to do this need to support independent filmmakers making good movies and trying to move some of these themes into the mainstream and get around some of the big studio noise. And so I would highly recommend that that you support a film like Exemplum by renting it. And that's what we'll do as soon as I get a free night. Oh my gosh, I really honestly planned to watch this before we sat down and did this interview, and it's just, you know, life is life. I mean, nothing on the scale that you were going through when you were making this thing, but I assume that your wife and your child are doing well and managed to get through that okay.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. They're doing wonderful. Yeah, I have a beautiful 3-year-old daughter now, you know, it was definitely hard on my wife for a while, but we made it through it, and you know, I dedicate the film to her at the very end of the credits because without her, I would not have been able to pull this off. No way.
Yeah, absolutely. And hey, look, I mean, I could do the same thing with my wife with everything that I do, and and I've mentioned that too. Anything that I do is really, it's both of us, because she sets things up so that I can accomplish the things that I managed to accomplish, including this. And that's also part of understanding, you know, Catholic marriage, I guess you could say, and the complementary nature of that. And it's good that, again, it's good to see those themes, in your life, as well as some of the other themes that are going to be in that I will see in Exemplum. It's already out, so people can watch this. What are you working on next? I guess now I'm curious as to do you have a project in mind for the next time out? Get
something. Well, that's a big question. So I did write another script last summer, and I just built a pitch deck for it right now, and we're just getting in the initial stages of actually taking it out to investors. I'm keeping that idea very secret because, you know, I know everybody says this about their project or whatever it is, but this actually has not been done before. So that's why I actually am keeping it on under wraps. But it is, it's actually very different. It's not in my wheelhouse at all. You would not expect it to be my next film. But I'll just give one tiny little hint. It is it's inspired by John Hughes' 80s teen movies. But that's all, the only hint I'll give for it.
There you go. Absolutely. Yeah, we were talking about that because we were talking about the age difference, and I was in, I'm in the age group that just basically shortly preceded the John Hughes generation of films in theaters. And look, I mean, it's great to, and it's great to do. It's great to do coming of age stuff. There's lots of great material that's new and original. You can do new and original things in all sorts of different genres.
Absolutely. But you were in high school, however, when Breaking Away was in theaters. Have you seen Breaking Away?
I was, and I saw it at the time. And it's a fine movie. Had some great talent in it.
I adore that movie. I adore Breaking Away. That's one of the inspirations behind the next film I'm writing right now. But yes, I adore Breaking Away. Wonderful film. Yeah.
Yeah. Also, another film that it wasn't a $10,000 budget, but it was not a big budget film. Even for that time, I don't think it was a big budget film. That was, you know, coming out of the 1970s, where, you know, there's a lot of independent films that were being made at the time. And Breaking Away ended up doing really well, if I recall correctly, in the awards season. And it was a sleeper film. They call it a sleeper film because it wasn't expected to do much because the people who were in it later on became, more prominent in films. But at the time, it really didn't have a breakout star in it. It was just a really good ensemble movie. And just, I remember, I mean, this is, again, 45 years ago, but my one memory of that film is the Italians sabotaging the bike.
Yeah.
You know, I'm part Italian. You know, I'm not Italian. My mother's family comes from Italy, a couple generations back from that, right? And I'm thinking, why did it have to be the Italians? And it was, yeah.
Well, at least it wasn't the French. So at least
Come in at the end, though. The French are the good guys at the end. So there you go. Kind of. I mean, it's just sort of a sluggish sort of thing. It's a great little film, right? And if that's where you're aiming at, you're aiming for the right thing, Paul, because that is what we need. We don't need any more huge films. What we need are small films. I got to just ask you, what did you think of The Holdovers? Did you get a chance to watch The Holdovers?
I very much appreciated The Holdovers. Yes, I thought it was a lovely film. I really want to try and give it another watch on Christmas this year. I love Paul Giamatti's character. I like the subtleties of his arc, especially, you know, when he points in, you know, this eye. I actually thought he got robbed of the best actor Oscar. I really appreciate it. Alexander Payne's one of my he always delivers something special. I've loved his films since Sideways, other than Downsizing, which is unfortunate, but yeah, I appreciate Holdovers.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, but I mean, The Holdovers is that type of film too, and it still can be done. And I was very impressed by The Holdovers, and I watched it over Christmas. It's actually New Year's. I watched it on New Year's Eve, So I mean, that's the type of filmmaking I think that you're aiming at, and I think that that's wonderful. So before we wrap up, I should give you an opportunity to tell people where they can find you and how they can support, other than, you know, renting the film rather than watching it for free, you know, how else they can support what you're doing.
Absolutely. You can follow me on Instagram or Twitter or X at Proland Films, Proland Films. Or you can read my articles every day at Breitbart.com under Paul Bois, or follow the film on Facebook, Exemplum.
Exemplum. That's where you need to go. That's what you need to go see next. That's what I need to go see next, and I'm planning on doing so. Paul, thank you so much for being with us. It's a pleasure talking with you. Hopefully we get a chance to do this again soon.
Thank you, Ed. I appreciate it.